Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. We are here in New Hampshire on First in the Nation primary day. So let's just commit a Granite State heresy. Let's do it right now. Let's ask it out loud. In 2020, exactly why should this small, mostly white New England state get to punch so far above its weight when it comes to presidential primaries? Is there something special in the water here? Something that makes New Hampshire voters more skillful at vetting big, boisterous groups of candidates? Should the rest of America be grateful that a couple hundred thousand voters here help winnow the field of presidential contenders for hundreds of millions of other Americans? Now, I hear some of you saying resoundingly, yes, but I also hear a growing number of you saying no. Okay, then. This hour on Point, New Hampshire's grip on presidential primaries, and the question, if you don't think the Granite State should go first, then who should? So that is what we're going to be exploring all hour today. And as I mentioned, we are right here in Manchester, New Hampshire. We've got great guests to help us explore these questions. And we are going to start with On Point's own Granite Stater, Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst. Jack, it is great to see you here in New Hampshire.
Meghna, my pleasure.
Okay, so give us a sense as to why the First in the Nation primary being in New Hampshire has been so important. I mean, it's been going on for some time.
It has, but really it got its modern start in 1952. Prior to that, people voted for delegates to conventions, not candidates. But in 1952, the ballot was open to essentially a beauty contest. Candidates could put their own names in. And led by the governor here, Sherman Adams, Republican governor, and the Senator Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts, they persuaded General Eisenhower, who was then the Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, to enter the primary, to put his name on the ballot. And he did, and Senator Taft did, and in a very small turnout, Eisenhower won, and that started him on his route to, two terms, ultimately. That was a big moment in this primary, and I think suddenly people became aware that this was an entry into national politics that had been closed hitherto because of the voting oddities. The second moment where it intersected fatefully with national history was in 1968 when Eugene McCarthy, senator from Minnesota, challenged sitting president LBJ in the primary. LBJ was ambivalent about running. He told his wife he wouldn't run. He was haunted by the specter of what happened to Woodrow Wilson, where he had a stroke in office and had to be essentially nursed to the end of his term. But he was back and forth, and meanwhile, 5,000 students, young people, came up here and cleaned for Gene. Beards were shaven, haircuts were cut, were made, and although Evans and Novak said McCarthy will be annihilated, although the Democratic Governor King and the Democratic Senator McIntyre both accused McCarthy of being disloyal to the country. McCarthy actually got 42% against LBJ's write-in 49%, and that was immediately seen as a big loss for the president because what had happened is the Tet Offensive had happened,
yeah.
And that changed everything. And LBJ withdrew within 2 weeks, made his famous March 31 speech where he says, "I will not run, nor will I seek, I will not," whatever that was.
Within 2 weeks?
Yes.
I had forgotten about that.
Yes, oh yes.
Okay.
And that was crucial, McCarthy's showing in New Hampshire. So New Hampshire helped to change history there.
Okay, so a mark on presidential history then, multiple marks from New Hampshire.
Yes.
You know, it's inescapable when you're here. And Jack, you live in New Hampshire, that Granite Staters do have this flinty sense of pride about being first, right? Like, and that supposedly they're good at it.
Yes, and they're cosseted by it. Dan Mackey, a columnist for the Valley News up where I am, writes, he says, "Friends and family who live in less fortunate states wonder what it's like to have an outsized role in choosing our next president. In 2016, Hillary Clinton shoveled my driveway twice during the primary campaign. She's stronger than she looks.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's the kind of, you know, that's a parody, but not too far of the sort of, you know, tete-a-tete, person-to-person contact that voters expect up here.
Now, Jack, I'm going to get this wrong, and I don't want to screw it up, but there's a pretty famous quotation about the differences between the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary.
Yes. This was Governor John Sununu in 1988. He said, the people of Iowa pick corn, the people of New Hampshire pick presidents.
Apologies once again to all of our Iowa listeners.
And it ain't true. Only 1 out of 10. So it's hardly the case for the Democrats, at least.
Those pesky facts, yes. Jack. Okay. Well, on that note, hang on here for a second, Jack, because joining us also in our Manchester studio is Lauren Chulgen. She is a political reporter for New Hampshire Public Radio and host of the terrific podcast that examines sort of these unassailable presumptions about New Hampshire's primary. The podcast is called Stranglehold. So, Lauren, it is great to see you.
It's great to see you too, Magna. I'm so happy to be here.
How often have you heard people give you that Governor Sununu quote about picking presidents?
I mean, besides just from him, I mean, I was the day after the Iowa caucuses were supposed to be complete, I went out. I've been covering Mayor Pete Buttigieg. And just going down the line at rallies, people were just like, what is going on? And the first voter I spoke with that morning made that joke to Mayor Buttigieg that, you know what they say, Iowa picks corn, New Hampshire picks presidents. And I went over to him after, I'm like, what are you doing? And he's like, that is the joke. That's how everyone feels right now. That, like, in that moment, people were so confused. You know, there is this myth that New Hampshire voters don't look to Iowa, right? Like, they're totally on their own. They don't care what Iowa does. But, you know, there's some nuance there. And also this year, I wouldn't say that's very true because the electability question is the question, right, Magna? So I've talked to a lot of voters who feel like they were looking for cues from Iowa. They got two of them, kind of. And then they were like, well, what does this mean for us? But to your point about quote-unquote flinty New Hampshire voters, yes, there are a lot of people in New Hampshire who love this thing and love the power it brings the state.
Okay, so we want to play some sound from the Stranglehold podcast because you guys really have reported very deeply on this. So about that sort of New Hampshire pride about being first in the nation regarding primaries, this is, you're about to hear from a voter that Jack Rodolico, also from New Hampshire Public Radio, talked to in Stranglehold Episode 5.
So, in its most authentic moments, this is what the New Hampshire primary is all about. Voters rubbing elbows with some of the most powerful people in American politics. This doesn't happen just anywhere.
Politics is my sport. And that's one of the reasons I love New Hampshire, because we really get involved in politics like other people get involved in football.
Football and politics in New Hampshire. But is that true? So this is one of those presumptions that you guys are questioning.
Yes.
Is politics a passion sport here?
For some people, yeah. Absolutely. Unquestionably, it is. I mean, if you just go down the street to where we are, Magna, like, the DoubleTree Hotel has been taken over by, like, every news network. And there are people from New Hampshire coming in and out. They're super psyched about all the attention we're getting. They feel like it's like the Olympics, right? But on the flip side, you know, that episode that you just played is a perfect one, because basically a bunch of us producers went to high school football games in New Hampshire on opening weekend because we figured, like, if this is the place where, like, normal New Hampshire people come, we want to test this out, right? Like, do people care about the primary? And it was hard to find people who were, like, super jazzed about the New Hampshire primary. They were like, I'm here to see my son play football. Like, what's the deal? Like, the primary's whatever. Other people would complain, like, God, these canvassers come to my door all the time. The candidates call my phone. So, yes, we do have an engaged population, but it's a segment of the population. And there's also a segment who's just, like, trying to get their kids to school today and, like, hoping they can squeeze in voting at some point.
So which segment, though, is the one that's engaged? Is it affluent? Is it middle class? Is it the people who have the room and the time and the money to host all those living room parties?
Absolutely.
To get Hillary Clinton to shuffle their driveway twice?
Twice, right, exactly. Jeez Louise. Well, you know, that's an excellent question, Magna, because think about some of these events are, right? Like 2 o'clock on a Tuesday. So some people can't, you know, skip work and get out to these things. These house parties are usually thrown by people who are in the political class in New Hampshire. And as the, you know, retail politics dynamic of the primary begins to change with the nationalization of the primary, primary, as we've seen with, you know, the DNC setting these thresholds for the debates. The people who are throwing these parties are state reps, people who are already really politically connected, people who have photos on their wall of themselves with like every past president, you know? So you're right. It is. That's certainly a big question.
Jack, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, it does. It's one of the grim truths about American politics that it takes leisure to follow it, to vote, to register. All of these things are difficult. New Hampshire does make it somewhat easier. You can have same day registration. You can shift your, you know, if you're an independent, you can shift to being a Democrat. On the other hand, New Hampshire now has, well, I guess it's in litigation, but it may soon have a voters will have to show their ID, you know, driver's license to be able to vote. And this because the Republican governor, John Sununu, does not want to...
Chris Sununu. John Sununu is the Iowa quote.
You know, Sununu is just the... It's been in the air here for as long as this primary has been going. But he doesn't want students voting. And so this is one way to discourage them voting.
I would also add that one of the things that people say, which is true about New Hampshire, is it's smaller, right? You talk to reporters who had to drive across the state of Iowa. They were in the car for hours on hours on hours. And, you know, one of the things that both reporters and campaigns and voters like about New Hampshire is that it's easy to get around. And that's a fact. But whether or not, you know, voters are able to have those one-on-one conversations with candidates in the way that they used to in the years that Jack was talking about, you know, that's a question.
Well, we'll talk more about that storied retail politics when we come back from a quick break. So we are questioning whether or not New Hampshire should be the first in the nation primary. On primary day here in New Hampshire, we put this question out to listeners, by the way, over a couple of days. We got a lot of responses. On Facebook, Kathy Kirchner says the first in the nation primary should be the last. All should occur at the same time on the same day so everyone gets an equal say. Let's see. We also have Niall Stuck on Twitter who says, Alaska. Alaska should be first. I want to see them in Nome in January. Let's see who really wants it. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It is primary day in New Hampshire. Yes, the first in the nation primary. We are here in Manchester, New Hampshire, daring to ask the question about whether this day should actually even be happening in 2020. In an era of billion-dollar presidential campaigns and 24/7 news media and the ubiquity of social media, is there something uniquely special about New Hampshire going first as presidential primary, or whether that should change? And I'm joined today by Jack Beattie. He is On Point's news analyst, usually joining us from Hanover, New Hampshire, but he's here with us in Manchester today. And Lauren Chulgin joins us as well. She's a political reporter for New Hampshire Public Radio and host of the Stranglehold podcast, an excellent podcast that's really questioning some of these sacrosanct presumptions about the New Hampshire primary. And Jack and Lauren, I want to talk to you about one of the central figures in New Hampshire that I believe he will go to his grave fighting to keep New Hampshire first.
And who could that be?
Talking about Bill Gardner, Secretary of State for New Hampshire, the king of the primary, if you will. He's been Secretary of State, Lauren, since 1970.
Over four decades.
1973,
yeah. 1973, four, yeah.
Okay, so a lot of time. So here he is. I just want to have folks hear his voice. This is back in November doing a press conference announcing this year's primary date and defending what we talked about a little earlier, the new voter ID law.
I think that when you balance the ease of voting with the security of the process, that's the desire. And when you do that, states will be like us. We are the easiest state in the United States to vote. And we will remain the easiest state.
That's Bill Gardner, the Secretary of State for New Hampshire. Now, Lauren, I just have to say, one of my first assignments as a reporter, like more than a decade ago, was a New Hampshire primary story.
It was a
year which I don't remember who it was, but some state threatened that they were going to come up in the calendar before New Hampshire. And I called up Bill Gardner thinking I'll never get him on the phone. He's a busy guy. He called back instantly. And he, on the phone, he told me, he said, if we have to go before Christmas, we will.
So you're talking 2008. I know exactly what you're talking about. Why is he
so passionate about this?
It's his identity. I think that's just unquestionable. The primary is a huge part of his identity. And also because the state has given him power to pick the date. And so that, you know, it's in state law that New Hampshire has to be a week before a similar election. It's in Iowa state law that we're like 8 days after them. And for Bill Gardner, you know, this is the number one priority of his job. And he's got a big job. He's Secretary of State. You know, there's a lot entrusted to him outside of this thing, right? But the reason why he's become known as this quote-unquote guardian of the primary is because he watches and strategizes every cycle to make sure that New Hampshire maintains this first in the nation spot. And so, you know, for many, many years, he's been the subject of all of these profiles as like this enigma in New Hampshire politics. And yet he's also had a very controversial side to, you know, you bring up, he talks about the easiest place to vote. That's become a very controversial partisan issue. And so his legacy has been really interesting to watch, especially during his most recent election. He was very closely challenged. There was a debate in the state house. He's elected by members of the state house. And, you know, it made people put lawmakers in a really tough spot because they felt like they had to choose between what they believed to be the person who's protecting the primary and who they think could be a better Secretary of State.
Yes, and he had signed on, and one of the few secretaries of state in the country, to this cockamamie, paranoid Trump conspiracy theory about the voter fraud. And he said, well, no, I'm going to look into it. This, when some of Trump's supporters were saying on TV, there were buses coming up. I saw them coming up.
There's not any evidence that happened.
The New Hampshire primary was being libeled, and Mr. Gardner was saying, well, let's look into this question. I mean, I thought he'd never survive after that.
But. Well, he hardly did. It was a really tough vote after that. But I will say that Secretary Gardner's response to all that was, I'd rather be at the table than on the menu. And his argument was, I'd rather, you know, if the president's having a commission about voter fraud, I want to be there. But that is obviously, that put him in a tough spot with, he's a registered Democrat, you know, and that put him in a really tough spot with members of his own party.
But I'm curious, there's always, not always, but in the past couple of cycles, there has been this murmur about why should New Hampshire
right.
be first. That murmur, I think, is rising to a much larger chorus.
Absolutely.
This year, without a doubt. And I'm sure you've asked Gardner about it. Like, What does he think?
Well, he hasn't listened to our podcast and hasn't wanted to sit down with an interview for it. However, separately, you know, I think that the heat is on New Hampshire, as, you know, it's being discussed all over the country right now, that given what happened in Iowa, people are looking to us with even more attention, if that's even humanly possible. And he would tell you that, you know, we're doing things the old-fashioned way and that, you know, you can't screw that up. And as he said in a story that one of my colleagues, Casey McDermott, did, you can't hack a pencil. So, you know, he's sticking to tradition as he always does.
Well, I actually just want to, since you mentioned that this year the stakes seem so much higher.
Yeah.
Thanks, Iowa. The morning after the Iowa caucus, that many people were calling a disaster because of the lack of a official result. The first caller into New Hampshire Public Radio's morning show.
Yes, the exchange.
On the exchange on that Tuesday said that a whole lot of people said out loud what a whole lot of people in New Hampshire were thinking, that what was happening in Iowa wouldn't just mean trouble for Iowa.
I have 2 points. The first one is, I think it's obvious Iowa, they can no longer be allowed to run the debacle last night. And unfortunately, I think they're going to take New Hampshire down with them.
Take New Hampshire down with them.
We do have this kind of like electoral sisterhood with them, Magna. We're like, you know, we're like both first in a weird way. Iowa is technically like the first contest, but we're the first primary and they're the first caucus. And so we've kind of struck a bond with them. You know, when there was this massive battle in the 90s about, you know, Delaware was trying to get closer to New Hampshire and Iowa had this pork convention that they were contending with. You know, at the outset of this calendar debate, the two states came together and the big politicians in each state were like, listen, we're not going to go down. We're not going to let the political parties take us down. We got to stick together. They will be harder to attack. And then what ended up happening is the calendar didn't work out in Bill Gardner's favor. Jack is nodding. He knows the story. And a fight broke out, essentially, between all these like big political power brokers in a house in New Hampshire, Iowa versus New Hampshire, and New Hampshire won. So, yes, we're tied with them, but there's a history of New Hampshire being like, well, we're going to do anything to make sure we're first.
Anything. Well, so I want to talk for a moment again about these vaunted retail politics that we hear so much about in New Hampshire, that because of the state's small size, that voters do get a chance to rub elbows, get up close and personal. We talked about who those voters might actually be, but form a more intimate relationship with the presidential candidates. And there is ample evidence of that, I have to say.
Oh, sure.
Our producers and I yesterday, when we were sort of like hanging out in various venues, we were surprised by how many people like refer to the candidates by their first names.
Yes. Yes. It's so odd to hear like Elizabeth, Bernie, Pete, like, yes, they have formal names. Like,
but I wonder if you think, and actually, Jack, let me start with you on this. Do you think that it actually sort of changes how the candidates talk to people when they're talking to them face to face? I mean, is that a good thing, or is it just sort of, I'm trying to beat down the political cynic in me, and they'll just say anything when they're face to face with a voter.
In some cases, if it's Joe Biden, they'll say anything. I think it puts, I mean, at least in my recollection of seeing candidates, it makes them talk more conversationally. They have to pitch what they're saying to smaller groups. Oratory is not necessarily in place there. And I attended a couple of these, Hillary Clinton in 2016, for example, at Dartmouth. She entered into a colloquy with people in the audience, and I've never heard, well, I mean, what do I know? But I've rarely heard her seem so there.
Right.
And she was connecting with people, connecting with what they were saying, with their backstories, asking them questions. Very impressed by how she was doing.
It is. There is no doubt that when you're face to face with the candidates, or you're at one of these events and you see the totality of how they interact with voters, it's a far different experience than when you hear sound bites, or definitely when you see ads on television. It's entirely different. But Lauren, again, on the other hand, in a presidential primary past, this one happened to be a GOP primary, I covered an event that Newt Gingrich had. Mm-hmm. He comes barreling into the restaurant, snowy New Hampshire winter day.
Classic.
Sits down. The room was packed. And he dives into this long conversation about what he's going to do about Northern Pass. Now, folks outside of New England may not know what Northern Pass was, but it was an idea. I'll just explain it for a second. It was an idea that an electric company had to bring power down from Canada to Massachusetts, and they were going to run very high voltage power lines right down the middle of New Hampshire, and people in the Granite State hated it. So Newt Gingrich comes in and says, I'm going to run all those lines underground. He just like made that promise. And I thought, are people buying this? Do they buy what they hear?
So this is why talking about retail politics is so complicated, Magna, because there are constantly like examples like that. Even in 2020, where someone like a Colorado Senator Michael Bennett, who like is a long shot, he is doing these town halls, right? He did 90 of them before today. And so, yes, those interactions are happening. Those candidates are saying, like, I know what's happening in your backyard. I know that you're concerned about your water. I know you're concerned about climate change, whatever. But then at the same time, like, this is a much more nationalized race. We brought up the debates earlier. And also, you know, when you have people as well-known as Elizabeth Warren who can draw in these massive rallies, Bernie Sanders, another prime example, you know, it's just Bernie Sanders is not like getting down in the crowd and like walking through all night long. Like he's throwing a huge party. He had a concert last night. Mm-hmm. So it's different, but you can't say that, you know, one exists without the other, right? We're still in this weird moment where both exist, but it's not just that retail politics is the only thing that's going to get you to the finish line.
Right. So, Jack, I mean, given where we are in 2020, and earlier in the show I was talking about the ubiquity of media, 24/7 news cycle, social media being even more relentless than that, the vast amounts of money that are spent, we'll talk about money in New Hampshire in a second, but nationally, I mean, do you think that New Hampshire voters are actually privy to learning something about the candidates that the rest of us aren't?
Well, I think they have a I'm aware, at least, of people feeling a kind of civic obligation to look into the candidates. Voting doesn't seem casual up here. Yes, people are undecided, but they're not undecided about voting or not voting. In fact, the turnout rate is pretty high for a primary, about 50%, isn't it?
It's higher than most states, yes.
Yeah. So that's an argument that they take it pretty seriously, and does it produce a better, more informed judgment? I don't know. But it certainly produces a great deal of political literacy, with familiarity with the issues, with how the candidates stand, and it isn't as, and you don't sense up here, at least, that there are many zeitgeist voters. People don't just go as the flow is. They're trying to pick, and so I'm impressed by that. I guess you could say the same thing about Iowa. People take it even more seriously there. The thing is, it's the composition of the people.
Exactly.
New Hampshire has bragged, I think I'm correct in this, that it's gone from about 3% African-American. Is it 6%? Something like that?
Well, it's certainly more diverse than it has
so,
been.
So, you know, that's...
It doesn't reflect...
Technically, that's a doubling of a small
right.
number.
Doubling.
That's what I was going to say.
That's the trend. But the trend is very unrepresentative of the Democratic Party and the country.
Well, that is the question, right? It doesn't look like the Democratic Party. This is a Democratic election. This is why... Or a Democratic primary. I mean, of course, the president's on the ballot as well. But, you know, to your point earlier, I mean, this is the first time... I mean, Jack would know this better than me, but I'm 100% sure. I'm pretty sure this is the first time we've ever heard a candidate while running for president. It's Julian Castro, former HUD secretary,
right.
who you know has dropped out. But while he was running, while he was looking for people in Iowa and New Hampshire to vote for him, just came right out and said, "I don't think this should be the way that it is." Mm-hmm. I mean, that's remarkable.
Well, I mean, he's not alone. We've got listener Aria McGrew who said there should be one primary on the same date nationwide for all the parties. The only people who benefit from this drawn out process is the media. Otherwise, there wouldn't be a whole year of reporting and hand-wringing. Interesting. So let's talk about who does benefit beyond like TV stations who are running a lot of ads here in New Hampshire, because another one of the shibboleths of the New Hampshire primary is that it's a great economic boon for this state. And the Stranglehold podcast, Lauren, you guys really investigated whether or not that's true. So let's listen to a moment from the podcast. This is Chris Malloy. He owns a company that specializes in producing live campaign events. And on the day that Stranglehold interviewed him, he was working on 5 such events. His website says something you probably haven't ever heard a business advertise. It says, specializing in custom designed and uniquely authentic experiences for both the audience and the world watching the first in the nation primary.
The stakes are high. If we were to make a mistake on a site and a flag were to fall or something while a candidate was speaking, it would be a national embarrassment for the candidate. So if you've got somebody on your production side like us, we understand all those stakes. We don't need to be reminded.
So, Lauren, is it true that New Hampshire gets this giant economic boost from all the people coming in and all the media coming in every 4 years?
Well, giant is hard to track, Magna. And this is what Casey McDermott and Jack Rodolico explored in this episode, where it's really hard to do the math on this. You mentioned the ads. Of course, like WMUR brings in a lot of money because of political ads. But Chris Malloy is a great example because there are these, like, you know, entrepreneurs that have sprung up that have been able to make a life off of the First of the Nation primary. He's one great example. Another one is Chris Blevins, who owns Chris Cosmetics. She's the person who does the makeup for all the candidates, all the network journalists that come in, all of us who have to be on TV and are on the radio usually and don't know how to do it. She's, you know, it's the official makeup studio for the New Hampshire primary. On their website, it says, "We don't pick sides, we pick shades." Chris is everywhere. And she, you know, they've made a career out of the New Hampshire primary. You know, people have found ways to make money off this thing. Of course, there's more people in hotels this week.
Yeah.
Of course, there's more people renting rental cars.
But Lauren, okay, great. So it might be good for individual businesses. Sorry, I didn't mean to be dismissive there.
No,
but
it's fine.
Or individual entrepreneurs. But for the state as a whole, again, like this is why it matters. I think in Stranglehold, you reported that there actually hasn't been an economic analysis of the impact of the New Hampshire primary
exactly,
in decades.
Exactly. And in part, that's because part of the argument was from Gardner and other people who want to protect this thing. They don't want this to look like it's about the money. They want this to look like it's about democracy.
But so how then? How do we know what the impact is?
Where Casey did as hard as she possibly could to figure it out, and there was an estimate a long time ago that says, you know, we don't even really beat out a good weekend in Loudoun. That's a NASCAR weekend. You know what I mean? So when you really think about it, it's also really hard to do this math. But that is certainly something that I feel like people that do math much better than me should check out.
The Loudoun Raceway is pretty cool. I mean, come on,
let's separate topic.
let's be honest. Okay, well, we're gonna head into a break here, but I want to hear from another one of our On Point listeners. This is Jill from Portland, Maine. She called us and proposed an alternative to the current primary system. Instead of one state gripping the title of First in the Nation, she thinks the position should be shared.
I've been thinking about this. It just hit me. Why is it the same two states every year? Why couldn't it be rotated? And I really can't say which state it should be instead of New Hampshire, because I don't think it should be any one state. I think it would be really interesting over the next 20 years or so to try rotating to different parts of the country and let two states, let's say from the south, two states from the west, or maybe mix it up, south and west, east, you know, whatever. But it just blows my mind that for so long we've been relying on Iowa and New Hampshire. Why?
Why? Well, that's the question we are exploring this hour as we talk about why New Hampshire is the first in the nation primary and whether it should remain that way. Lots more to discuss. We'll also look ahead to Nevada. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are in Manchester, New Hampshire today because it is primary day, the first in the nation primary in New Hampshire. And we're asking the question about why New Hampshire goes first as a primary state in a presidential contest and whether it should remain as such. And joining us to discuss this is Jack Beattie. He's On Point's news analyst. And Lauren Chulgen is with us as well. She's a political reporter from New Hampshire Public Radio and host of the Stranglehold podcast. Put it in your feed if you don't have it already. We're getting a lot of comments here, by the way, guys, about what folks think or who should go first. There's Bonnie here who tells us on Facebook, no single state should be first. There should be either regional primaries or, like another person suggested, states from different Census Bureau regions should be grouped together for primaries. Too much importance right now placed on individual early states. And then Bonnie also says she wants ranked choice voting as well. I mean, I think the idea of regional primaries is kind of an interesting one. It gets us closer to that question of how do we achieve a representative primary schedule. But back to New Hampshire, though, Lauren, I mean, are there particular races here that you think really epitomize why there's such a mythology around the New Hampshire primary?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've become kind of obsessed with the 1976 Jimmy Carter campaign, mostly because, you know, a lot of people talk about it as like the campaign that birthed Iowa, right? Which is true. And I don't want to take that away from them. But for us, it did a really interesting thing where it created the mythology of the long shot campaign, what it takes for someone who isn't known well to come to New Hampshire and win and get all the way to the White House. And it also, you know, when I started digging around, that campaign really built the modern day Democratic Party in New Hampshire. I mean, when we look at some of these like establishment power broker Democrats like Billy Shaheen, the husband of Gene Shaheen, our senior senator, former governor, they got their start on this campaign. You know, the head of the Democratic Party, Ray Buckley, was like a 15-year-old volunteer knocking on doors. You know, these are the same people that build the party today. But as far as the mythology, you know, Jimmy Carter slept in people's houses, Meghna. He, you know, no one knew him. He brought in the Peanut Brigade, which was a group of his, like, friends and family members from Georgia who, like, felt that given what had happened with Nixon, felt like people really wanted to get to know their next candidate and feel like they could trust them. And the best way they thought they could do that is with real honest conversations with people who knew Jimmy Carter personally. And that has stuck in people's minds. And that story has happened time and time again. John McCain, Bill Clinton, mm-hmm. even Gary Hart for a short period of time. You know, people who came here and either their candidacy was struggling or no one knew them. And people remember that, you know, and the people who love the New Hampshire primary, Billy Shaheen among them, will tell candidates that when they come here. Did you see what Jimmy Carter did? You could do that too. However, I just feel like in 2020, that story is not maybe not as possible as it has been.
Right. Or doesn't, it's not as possible or doesn't even need to be
right.
that possible. And here's Jack, and I'll turn this to you because here's why I make that distinction. I looked at the 2016 race on the GOP side and how Donald, then candidate Trump, ran his campaign. My producer, Dori Scheimer, pointed this out. It's a really, really great point. Like, you know, then candidate Trump, he didn't work the rope line all that much. You know, he wasn't doing, as far as I can remember, living room house parties.
Voters anywhere. Met him on TV.
They met, but he was in people's living room in another way.
Yes. Exactly.
On television, and all of those rallies, given wall-to-wall coverage. That is a way of getting to voters in their homes, not what we recognize from history, but it was incredibly effective for him.
Yes.
Could it be effective for other candidates moving forward as well? Is that the world that we're in right now?
Well, it's much closer to the world we're in, where we don't, you know, expect we're going to go down to the Cracker Barrel and listen to the candidate talking. And that is a vivid example of how theatricality, the media, the monoculture has eclipsed some of the intrinsic advantages of New Hampshire. I mean, everything now happens in the glare of TV.
Mm-hmm. And can I say, Magna, what you just articulated is the fear among many people in New Hampshire. That's their worst fear, that this primary will become nationalized and New Hampshire won't do what some people believe it does best, which is meet candidates face-to-face and provide like this perfect form of democracy. That's what people in New Hampshire who love the primary sell here. And they feel like the more national this gets, the more it's only on TV, we can't provide the service that some would argue we provide.
So
that's the argument.
Let's talk for a second about how powerfully people do feel about this, Lauren, because
yes.
even the fact that New Hampshire Public Radio dared to put a podcast out
yes.
questioning the sacrosanct presumptions of the New Hampshire primary, it has made you not so popular here.
Yes, I'm from here. I grew up here. I went to college here where the debate was on Friday night. Like, I am very much from here.
Governor Sununu tell you this is a total disaster?
He told me he's very disappointed and he hates it. And, you know, but you know, here's the thing. You know, I'm a political reporter. People don't always love what you do. But what's been interesting to me is not that just people don't like it, but that they don't like it because all they expect from journalists in New Hampshire is positive coverage or things that defend the First of the Nation primary. Because honestly, Magna, that's been the culture here for years and years and years. No one has really raised the question. And we're not doing anything like crazy. We're asking questions that any journalist would ask. You know, to me, it's not our job to defend the First of the Nation primary, and it's not our job to say that it shouldn't be here. We're just raising questions because this is the most powerful institution that we've got. To your point about money, to your point, we were talking about, you know, the hotel down the street with ABC, MSNBC, all these like big news networks right downtown. Like, we get a lot of attention from this thing. And so raising the question is just the job. But yes, people are not pleased. But other people like it, I should say. Like,
you're losing friends?
That was the headline in the New York Times, and I'm losing friends. But I've got a lot of texts from people who say they're still my friend.
Making new friends, too, okay? Well, listen, the news doesn't stop, even though we might be taking a step back look here. We've got word that former Vice President Joe Biden is actually leaving for South Carolina to go to South Carolina early today, and he'll plan to address New Hampshire supporters via live stream from South Carolina. Earlier today, the former vice president conceded that it's a tough race for him in New Hampshire, hoping for better results he is in South Carolina. Now, that might say more about Biden's campaign than the New Hampshire primary itself, but really interesting. And this also gives us the avenue to expand our conversation a little bit because there will be next steps after today, and the next steps come very quickly. So I'm really delighted to say that joining us in the New Hampshire studio is Megan Messerly. On Point listeners have heard her a couple of times on the show in recent weeks because she's politics reporter for the Nevada Independent. And the Nevada caucuses are on their way, Megan.
They are. They are so soon upon us. Everything turns to Nevada starting tomorrow.
Last time we talked, there was still a question about how the caucuses would be run following the Iowa app disaster. Do you have an answer for that?
We have a half answer to that. So late last night, I received a copy of a memo that the Nevada State Democratic Party sent to campaigns, letting them know how the early vote process would work. So we have 4 days of early voting in our caucus for the first time ever. This was an effort to expand the caucus process. You know, typically you used to have to show up on Saturday at noon. Folks have lives, they have work, they have kids, they have 24/7 jobs because they're in Las Vegas. So we're going to have 4 days of early voting. So they've now announced how early voting is going to work. It was going to use an app on a tablet. It will now be a paper, a scannable form, kind of like a Scantron. That's how people are going to be voting for the early vote.
A Scantron. Okay, at least people should be at least familiar with that.
Yes.
Hopefully.
Exactly.
Okay, so you're here in New Hampshire.
I am.
Today.
I made it all the way here. It's a little bit colder than Las Vegas.
What are you looking for?
Yeah, it's been really interesting, I think, talking to voters here. And I was in Iowa as well. And I think it has been interesting to get the sense of the differences, I think, in how people approach their role. There really is this sense in Iowa and New Hampshire of people feeling like this is their civic duty and they are responsible for choosing the next presidential nominee. And I think in Nevada, there's some of that, but it's not quite as pronounced. We have only been an early nominating state since 2008, so we don't have this like decades and decades long culture of doing this. But the one thing I will say that Nevadans are very defensive of is the fact that we are the first diverse nominating state. And people are very vocal about that and the fact that we play an important role in the process because we do look more like the rest of the country.
Well, and a lot more. A lot more.
Yes.
I think I was seeing some census numbers that said 30% of Nevadans are Latinx.
Yep, that's correct.
At least that.
Yep, exactly. Yep, and 10% Asian American, Pacific Islander, 10% African American as well.
Okay, so let's just hear a little bit from a listener who called us. This is Nancy from Tynemouth, Vermont, and she called to make the case for either a larger state to go first or a group of states. We've heard that from a bunch of listeners today to claim the start of primary season.
Like many, I think that the first two primaries are in states far too small and far shy of a sense of diversity to make a good lead in to the primary season. Human nature, my argument is that it should either be a state large enough and diverse enough to reflect a broader collection of thought and opinion and belief, or, like Super Tuesday, should be enough states to be representative of the nation.
That's Nancy from Tynemouth, Vermont, by the way, another small state. I don't know how you get a Super Tuesday-like primary grouping without edging towards what's a de facto national primary, right? Let me, Lauren, you're shaking your head.
Yeah,
yes.
I think that's certainly the argument. I mean, you know, what are they going to do? Fly into airplane hangars and then like give a speech and then get back on the airplane and go elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's why I say that New Hampshire people who love the primary have that fear that like we can provide that they have to keep coming here versus on Super Tuesday where they have to be everywhere all at once and they can't really make time to meet people.
Right. Go ahead, Megan.
Yeah, I think that's the argument in Nevada as well, right? We're not a terribly large state. You know, we have certain population centers. You can come to Las Vegas. You can come to Reno. We have a smaller town, Elko, as well, where some people come. And people do like the fact that you have to come through repeatedly, right? And you are making this argument over and over again. And there's something, I think, to be said for that and having this vetting over the course of several months, whereas you can't really do that if you're trying to do that in so many states at the same time.
Right.
I mean, the two of you, like, compare notes here. What has it been like reporting on the presidential race so far in both your states?
I keep looking at Megan and thinking, like, she's about to go through what I just went through.
Yep, I know.
Like, you're so about to be in it,
yep.
You know? That's the wild thing. When you talk about who benefits, like, Megan and Lauren benefit big mm-hmm. time. You know, we're reporters in small states where normally we'd be covering the state house or,
yep.
You know, and now the whole world looks at you and looks for an answer, you know, especially this year when, like we've been talking about, electability is the question on Democratic voters' minds. And so people want to see results. And so where are they going to turn these first four states? And that's why, like, I've been on TV a million times and I'm sure Megan will be too.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, I think that's so true. I think there's a sense from people on the ground that they want to meet the candidates in person, right? They want to shake their hands, you know, Cory Booker in a living room, you know, doing some of those retail politics type things. You know, candidates especially, they tend to do more of this really between New Hampshire and Nevada, but more of the retail politics. politics, you know, stopping by the local supermarket or stopping by an ice cream shop. They tend to do more of that in these last few days before the caucus, but people really do enjoy that and getting sort of this firsthand, you know, knowing a person as a person and not just a candidate.
As a person, but what about as a politician with ideas and potential policies? I mean, really, when the rubber meets the road, you're not going to be having beer with the president, except on the most rare of occasions when that person, whomever she or he is in the White House. I mean, this is what I'm wondering about these early primary and caucus states. Do we get a distortion of personality and empathy and warmth and human contact over actual ideas and policies, where it's those ideas and policies, Jack, that are going to have the most direct impact on the nation as a whole?
You can argue that, but you can also argue, looking at our current incumbent, that character is primary. And that people do get a sense of someone's character. I think Joe Biden showed that in just a town hall just last week, where he was asked about his stuttering, the struggle he's had all his life with that. And he gave such a response to, I think it was a, I don't know if she was a speech teacher, I forget. But anyway, he talked the whole problem through, and he said to kids, don't, you know, you're going to get through this. This is going to work. You practice. It was a lovely human moment. And I think it did show character.
I will also say that, you know, New Hampshire is a really strong activist community, and, you know, bird dogging, which is basically someone in an activist group showing up at a candidate event to make sure their question about their issue gets answered. You people have figured out how to get their issues in front of powerful people. So it's not that I totally think the personality part is a huge part of it. I talk to people every day who say, I just want to see what they're really like in person. That's important to people. But I do think that, like, issues do get raised, questions do get asked. You know, people in New Hampshire, maybe not on the whole, not 100% of the people who live here, but there are enough people who want to ask about healthcare or prescription drug costs. But
I mean, I hear that. And look, I live right next door to the Granite State. I love New Hampshire, but I'm, you know, people in California, in Texas, in Florida, in New York, in Nevada, in Wisconsin, in Pennsylvania, in Ohio, they are perfectly capable of asking those same questions too.
I know, it's crazy. That's the thing that I've had to be talking about for so many weeks, because people, this is the thing, right? Like, people are like, why does New Hampshire get to be so special? I probably could come up with some questions if you guys gave us a shot, but New Hampshire, the argument from the people who love this thing is we do it better. And that's just the thing, you can't, like, how do you measure that?
And personality breaks through. I mean, in 2008, Barack Obama really said something very snide in a debate with Hillary Clinton. He said, "You're likable enough, Hillary." Just, I think, an uncharacteristic comment, and I'm sure one that his wife spoke to him about. Well, the next day, Hillary, at an event, I think down here, started to choke up and cry.
That's
not
right.
About that particular thing, but someone said, "Isn't it rough being in this?" And she started, that moment decided the primary for her. And suddenly there was a moment of human, she wasn't just this robot who could go through anything, that the drubbing, the condescension had taken its toll, and she showed it, and that made a difference.
Excellent point. Well, you know, after today, as we move, Megan, to Nevada and South Carolina, in a sense, it also becomes a very different kind of race, as well as the rest of America starts having its say. So we'll see what happens. And Lauren, I imagine that maybe in the next quadrennial cycle, we might be coming back and asking the same set of questions about why New Hampshire is first again, but we'll see. So Lauren Chooljian, political reporter at New Hampshire Public Radio and host of the Stranglehold podcast, thank you so much for joining us.
This is so fun.
And Megan Messerly, politics reporter for the Nevada Independent. It's great to see you here in New Hampshire, and looking forward to talking to you in Nevada as well.
Yes, thanks so much.
And Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst. It is great to see you across the table, Jack. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.